Well, before coming here today, I really like my job. And after and after listening to everybody, I really, really like my job. So I feel I'm in a really fortunate situation. So I'm happy to be able to talk to you today about the project I work with, which is the West Eugene Wetlands Program. And there are a lot of things we've done with this with the project, and today I'm going to try to focus the majority of my talk on the criteria that were used to set priorities for protection, acquisition, and mitigation. So where are we? We are at the southern end of the Willamette Valley ecoregion, which is over here on the west side of Oregon. The Willamette Valley probably has about 90% of the population of Oregon in it. The largest city, Portland, is up here at the north. Eugene Springfield is down at the very south. The Eugene Springfield metro area is the second largest metro area in Oregon. So here you have the Cascade Range with peaks like Mount Hood, the Three Sisters, and over here in the orange is the Coast Range. So water from the slopes of both of those comes down into the primarily flat Willamette Valley. It's a fairly flat, broad valley. So what does it look like? For the most part, we're dealing with wet prairie and upland prairie habitats with streams that go through them and some vernal pools that are in small pockets within the prairies. The lower parts of the floor are in the wet prairie, and then there's usually a transition to some sort of upland prairie, and then oak savanna and oak woodland in the upper portions. And it can be really beautiful. We're in a very urbanizing area, but even so, within their city limits, you can have views where you have protected wetlands now without any infrastructure or buildings in your sight. So the major steps that have happened with our program go back to 1988, and there was about a 3 to 4 year planning process. And that's what I'm going to talk about mostly today. Part of why I think I'm really happy where I work is because not only was this a planning process, but there was a product, which was a decision product, which was a land use decision. So all those things were taken care of with one adoption process by city, county, and then ultimately, although it wasn't an official adoption process, both state and federal regulatory agencies have acknowledged it and do all their permitting consistent with our local plan. So I was hired right here in 1999, and I get to do all the fun stuff, which is all the implementation, which has included a lot of acquisition, active land management, some of it with a mitigation bank, which is operated by the city of Eugene, some of it by other sources that aren't mitigation bank. We have a very successful education program, and we are now having recreation facility development, which is mostly like multi-use paths and some parking lots on the outside, which allow the public to access our wetlands. So again, today I'm going to focus on the criteria, inventory, and public process. Before I jump ahead, do want to set a little bit of context for how we were able to do this. The state of Oregon has a couple things. First, they have a state removal fill removal law that's pretty analogous to the federal law. But in addition, they have two additional things. One, they have a state land use planning process, which requires every jurisdiction to meet about 15 land use planning goals. One of those goals pertains to natural resources. So every jurisdiction, regardless of size, is required to go through a planning process for natural resources, of which wetlands is one of the key. Wetlands, streams, and significant upland habitat are required by every jurisdiction to be inventoried and have policies adopted for them. So it was really in 1988 that process had started in the western part of Eugene for wetlands, and people said, whoa, we never realized there are wetlands out there, and almost, you know, a huge portion of what they were surveying had wetlands. So that caused people to think, well, what are we going to do with that situation? Are we just going to go through the parcel-by-parcel permitting process where developers will be uncertain of the outcome and the ecological benefits won't be known and probably won't be very good if you're going to have a case-by-case mitigation for those impacts? Or can we utilize a newly created state regulation which allows local jurisdictions to bring the wetland regulatory planning process to the local jurisdiction? And that's what the city of Eugene did. They decided way back here that they would rather, as a local jurisdiction, take on the heat and plan on an ecological, hydrological basis for a portion of Eugene rather than do a case-by-case scenario. So that really is what set the framework for this whole thing. So far, we're the only, even though that law was in existence way back in the late 1980s, the city of Eugene is still the only city in Oregon to utilize the Wetland Conservation Plan rule to do that. Other jurisdictions have tried, and they've run up against different political obstacles, and they've dropped it. So how were the criteria developed? For one, there was a technical advisory committee that was comprised of city planners, consulted planners, and a lot of state and federal regulatory agencies and wetland consultants. But they weren't the ones who really made the final decisions. There were extensive efforts to get the community involved from the first step. There were 7 public workshops. There were opinion surveys that were available at the workshops, as well as mail to about 10,000 property owners within the plan boundary. There were field trips sponsored on a very regular basis to do bird watching or just to talk about wetlands and the importance of wetlands, but doing that out in the field. We had a speakers bureau bringing in various experts to talk about wetlands, their importance, what wetland regulations were. Direct contacts with affected property owners, and then a whole series of public hearings, both before planning commissions of the city and the county, as well as the elected official bodies of the city and the county. So during the 4-year planning process, about 25% of the budget was spent on getting scientific input from staff or consultants. 75% of the budget was spent on working with the public, getting their buy-in, and getting their input. And I think that's, both this point 2 up here and this point 2 down here really go back to sort of that big bracket that Eric Stein talked about earlier about getting public input at every step, and it was very much on the forefront of what happened in our process. And part of that is because, again, the state land use laws that we have require public involvement from the first step. So part of that was driven by our state land use planning laws, which require public involvement. So some of the key questions that were asked early on that set the priorities were, one, where would wetland management, including mitigation, most likely succeed in perpetuity? So one thing was we wanted to look at was where historically were wetlands in the area. Then the second one was where do we still have wetlands? Where we have wetlands, which ones are high quality, which ones are not very high quality? And number 4, where is there hydrologic connectivity to major streams, or where are the current wetlands within the 100-year floodplain? Because we're in an urban area, there's been a lot of hydrological disconnection with roads, streamside ditches, agricultural channels and such, so that was a big one. In addition, we had some special circumstances which made other areas pop out in importance to people. One, we have a lot of rare plants. Eugene, because it's in the southern part of the Willamette Valley, which for the most part is the least populated, with the exception of the Eugene residential urban area, is really one of the best remaining areas in the entire Willamette Valley for the whole suite of species that formerly occurred there. And that includes both plants and animals. They also looked at where, under the current land use plan, where are areas that are currently designated for natural resource protection. Then there was a big emphasis on both habitat and hydrological connectivity, and also a big emphasis on the wet prairie habitat type, which is the predominant, or was the predominant habitat type in the area, and only about 1% of it remains in the entire Willamette Valley, so we made that a priority. So historic vegetation. We were fortunate in that people had been working on reconstructing the vegetation of the area from the General Land Office survey data. And this black boundary, which you'll see throughout the talk today, is the plan area boundary that we used. It's kind of an artificial boundary that follows no particular hydrologic or political boundary, but it was kind of roughly the area that was thought to have the majority of the wetlands. The majority of it falls within the Eugene city limits, but some of it is outside the city limits and therefore is in county jurisdiction. The major streams, this is called Willow Creek. This stream is called Amazon Creek. Willow Creek joins Amazon Creek. Eventually, portions of it go into a reservoir. The other parts go to a river, which ultimately goes to the Willamette River. So you can see that these orange habitats and these pink blobs, that is wet prairie habitat. And it's fairly closely associated with the major stream corridors. The yellow habitat is upland prairie. and the greenish habitat is savanna-type habitats. So for the most part, historically, this is very open habitat. There are some fairly subtle topographical differences which distinguish the wet prairie and upland prairie habitats, and then farther up, as you get up in elevation, you get into the savannas. So the second step, once we understood where historically the wetlands were to do an inventory. We asked for on-site access to every single property in that planting area. And for those people who denied that, we basically let them know that we were undergoing a regulatory process. If they did not give us access to their property, they'd have to accept the results of an off-site aerial photo interpretation. And if they thought that was to their benefit, great. And if they didn't, then you know, they were going to have to live with the consequences. So most people gave us access to their property. So it wasn't a full field delineation. It was under the Oregon regulation, they allow you to do a kind of a scaled back type of delineation, which isn't not as time or data intensive as a full scale delineation. And in addition, there were two different types of quality assessments that were done. I won't go into the details of those. They're probably outdated and wouldn't be used today, but two different kind of quantitative measures of quality were conducted at the same time. Step four was to look at, so all the green here are wetlands, are areas that were mapped out as being wetland. And priority status was given to wetlands that were in close proximity to the major streams or within the mapped 100-year floodplain. And the, you know, the general consensus, the general idea is that all these characteristics are going to ultimately be compared for a given site, and those that, for example, are closer or within the 100-year floodplain get a higher priority than those that are not. So this is, I don't have great examples of this, but this is a channel during a non-flooding event that just shows that the majority of the water is confined within that channel. And during a flooding event, this happens about four or five times a winter, the water overflows those banks and floods several hundred acres of the floodplain. Then we also wanted to map and document the locations of rare plants. These weren't listed at the time, but we did have a series of, I think, about 15 plants that were considered rare at the time. Now three of them are federally listed, and the other ones are either some condition of being considered for state or federal listing. So we have Erythrina decumbens, Lomatium bradshawii, and Kincaid's lupin are all federally listed currently. We also have two rare animals. The Fender's blue butterfly is an endangered species, and its caterpillar host plant, its only caterpillar host plant, is the threatened Kincaid's lupin. Western pond turtles are a state species of concern. Their best populations in the entire Willamette Valley are in Eugene. They're, for the most part, extinct all the way, extinct in the state of Washington, mostly extinct in the Portland area, and they get increasingly common as you get south in the valley. I have nothing to say about existing zoning except that it was looked at. There were very few areas that had existing zoning for natural resources, but those areas kind of automatically got into a protected status if they existed. And then the final one, or second to last one, is habitat connectivity. There was a very strong emphasis on giving priority to things that were in big blocks of connected habitat, and areas that were these little pockets that were disconnected from other things were put on a much lower priority. And finally, there was a emphasis on protecting wet prairie habitat. So this map here shows the different habitat types. This light green is wet prairie. Dark green is a forested wetland, and the other colors mean different things. But again, there's only 1% of wet prairie habitat that remains in the entire Willamette Valley. The West Eugene Wetlands area is still one of the best areas for bigger blocks of it. And so that was not only an emphasis for protection, but in our mitigation bank, if there are any impacts to wet prairie habitat, the mitigation ratio that the developer is required to purchase are much higher than for non-wet prairie habitats. So we use that information as well as the existing state law. The existing state law actually had these as kind of predetermined categories that you could come up with land use designations on. So there were three designations originally. protect, and those mean that if that land use designations apply to it, those wetlands cannot be developed, and there are setbacks at various distances from the edge of the wetland. Restore virtually means the same thing. You cannot develop on it, but there are no setbacks. And develop means that that site can be developed per the state and federal regulations. The idea here from the get-go was that anything that was designated in those first two categories would be acquired by the city or one of our partner agencies. So, wetland site, there was no real consistent way that a site was determined. Sometimes it happened to do with if there was a large single owner parcel, that might be a site on its own. In other cases, there might be several adjacent small parcels, and that was considered a site. But the sites were kind of assigned in a partial matrix of letters across the top and numbers across the bottom. So you might have site A1, site A2, site B1, B2. We disassociated owner names from those sites. And then most of those criteria, those nine criteria that I mentioned before, were binomially scored. So either got a zero or a one. And for each of these categories, each of those criteria were listed, and it was not a mutually exclusive ranking system. So each site was evaluated according to the criteria that were developed for protect versus restore and versus develop. And the planners involved had to sort of assign a quantitative rank for each of those and then develop a conclusion about which designation that they thought should be assigned to that site. Those then went through the political adoption process through the planning commissions and the elected official bodies. And so the public adoption processes were, I was not involved in the original ones, but we've had a couple amendments as new wetlands have been identified. And they are incredibly interesting because on one hand, you might have the lawyers from a multinational company there with very slick presentations. And on the other side, you have someone dressed up as a Fender's Blue Butterfly with a guitar singing a song. So it's quite interesting as a staff person involved or as you watch the elected officials trying to keep their face straight as they're listening to the Froggy song or the Fender's Blue Butterfly song. But ultimately, the City Council of Eugene unanimously, there's a eight-member city council, they unanimously adopted the designations, and our county had a 3-2 split, 3 in favor and 2 against, to adopt the policy recommendations. And so the ultimate thing was a land use plan. It has maps. It has land use implications. It basically, well, I'll get to that later. So it was adopted by the city, adopted by Lane County, and then the Oregon, what's now called the Oregon Department of State Lands, officially recognized that as a wetland conservation plan, which means that they from that point forward would do all their permitting consistent with what we had adopted locally. And the EPA and the Army Corps, I think, had a less formal adoption process, but they basically gave us a very nice certificate and a very nice letter that said, we acknowledge your plan, we think you did great work, and we will also permit consistent with that. So the broad objectives of this plan, I probably should have said that initially, were really to find a balance between wetlands protection and sound urban development. This is an area within the city limits, slated, most of it was zoned for industrial development. So there was definitely an interest in accommodating that development for the growth and economy of the area, and then also to meet state and federal laws and regulations. So here was the balance that was struck. Of the planning area, which is almost 8,000 acres, 81% was non-wetlands, and 19% was wetlands. Of that 19% that was wetlands, 79% was put into either the restore or protect, which means that no development could occur on 79% of the wetlands that were found. 21% could be developed. From my standpoint as an ecologist and as I go out there and manage on a day-to-day basis, I am so thrilled with this. I think the balance was very much ecologically sound. I'm amazed at this point how much was able to be put into the protect or the restore designations. I think there was a lot of good public outreach that went into that. There were some very good persuasive people who were involved who really were able to set the stage for this type of thing. We had elected officials who were willing to listen. And I think we had a lot of luck. And at the time, I think Eugene was small enough that there were not a lot of land use attorneys that had been active. I think today it would be difficult for us to do this because almost every land use application that comes in today has a land use attorney side by side with the developer himself or herself. But at the time, 1982, this is what we were able to get passed. So since that adoption of that plan in 1992, a partnership is formed. And really from the get-go, even before the plan was adopted, the city, the Nature Conservancy, and the BLM were working in partnership. And I can't stress enough how important this partnership is to the success of our program. Excuse me. For one, without the BLM from the get-go, we could not have said sincerely that we had the means to acquire all those properties which we had then said could not be developed. But having the BLM on board, we had a pretty good indication that we had a strong way to get funding from the federal government to acquire lands that were being designated for protect or restore. So in the first 5 years of the partnership, really was the city, the TNC, and the BLM that were the partners. In the last few years, other agencies have come on board. They've approached us because they view the partnership as successful, and they see a mutual gain from them joining us and for both them and for the partnership. This particular group focuses exclusively on wetlands education, so they are now taking charge of all the educational opportunities. During May, which is American Wetlands Month, we're servicing over 1,000 people just in May with various field trips and presentations. Mackenzie River Trust is a local land trust. Oregon Youth Conservation Corps is a group that tries to put youth at risk to work doing conservation-oriented projects, so that really ties us into the community in various ways. Fish and Wildlife Service is recently come on and working with us. We are now trying to create a new unit of a wildlife refuge to even expand further the acreage that we have. The Army Corps of Engineers has been very instrumental in bringing 1135 project funds to our project. So the four major things we do now, and I'm going to do a little bit about implementation, are land acquisition, land management, recreation facilities, and environmental education. So this is, I've talked a couple times, I think when Eric Stein talked, I said I'd like you to put in plan implementation because our plan adoption, because adoption of a plan, especially if it has policy and multiple entities have adopted it, is really powerful. So our land acquisition up until 1992 was about 300 acres. Once that plan was adopted, we could then go to all the granting agencies and say, look, we have a plan. It's been adopted by city, county, state, federal agencies. You should fund us because we can do something. And our trajectory is very solid. We've had about $20 million since 1992 in acquisition funds. We've used local money, state grant funds, a large amount of federal funds. We had $12 million so far in LWCF, $1 million in NACA, and we've just started, I think, with about $300,000 in WRP funds. And then we also have private funds, either Nature Conservancy management dollars or some people donate land to us for the tax benefits. So this gray box is the West Eugene Wetland Plan boundary, the official boundary. Our acquisition is not limited to that. So even though the total number of wetlands within our project boundary was about 1,400 acres, we have currently acquired 3,000 acres of land. And what happens is that we, for one, don't acquire just wetlands. We usually acquire a parcel, which is a combination of wetlands and uplands. And in addition, we're acquiring outside of our plan boundary because the ecological benefits in other areas are also very important. So the different colors within here, this dark green is the Nature Conservancy, this salmon colored is BLM, the light green is City of Eugene, and we still, TNC owns out here, Mackenzie River Trust up here, more BLM land, and the story is not over. We are actively trying to purchase more. The interesting thing is out here, that's about $2,000 to $3,000 per acre. Here, it could be as much as $300,000 per acre. So what we typically do when we apply for grant funds is put in a request for that will buy lands here, as well as we're still trying to get that one. That's about $1 million for about 80 acres, and something out here would get a lot more acres for that money. So we do lots of land management. We have a mitigation bank, which the city operates. And we currently charge $50,000 per acre. We average sales about 8 credits per year. But we also have a lot, we actually have more restoration that's been done on non-bank projects. And for example, the Nature Conservancy owns about 400 acres. They don't allow mitigation bank in their property, so they actively do restoration and enhancement with their own funding. We've had one very large 1135 project. We have other grants. For example, this last year we got almost $1 million in Cooperative Conservation Initiative project funds, which is a brand new funding source through the Department of Interior. There were $5 million allocated nationally. We got $1 million just for our project. We got Gail Norton to come out. We got the BLM director, Kathleen Clark, to come out. Very big deal. We have various research projects. For example, we have a $200,000 wetland development grant from EPA that we're starting to do a large-scale experimental design on different site preparation techniques and how those site prep techniques ultimately lead to impacts on the vegetation as well as the soil. And then we have future things that we want to bank, haven't gotten quite up there yet, as well as all the uplands. And we are doing restoration and enhancement on uplands using a variety of sources as well. Recreation is an area that we've just started working on. We have a multi-use path now that bikers and bird watchers and hikers and people just out wanting to visit our open space can use. We have a fairly active education program now. We have year-round programs that target both adults and children. We have a formal curriculum for third to fifth graders. We really try to make it a field-based experience. And the last 2 years, we've serviced about 1,500 people. This year, I think it's going to be more about 3,000 people. And we're really amplifying that to get the community involved. And we have interpretive signage in various places as well. So a summary of our accomplishments. One, we adopted a land use plan that has been very successful. We have memorandum of understandings among the various partners that outline what our common shared vision is and who's going to be responsible for what. On the ecological side, we've acquired 3,000 acres of land and continue to seek more acquisition. We have achieved a decent level of landscape and hydrological connectivity, and we have protected rare species and habitats, and I'm really, really proud to say that every one of our listed species, the populations of all of those have been growing over the last few years due to our management. On the mitigation bank side, we're meeting local developers' needs for their mitigation. We've sold over 78 credits since 1994. It's a fairly financially stable, even though it does fluctuate a little bit. We are averaging about 8 credits per year in sales. And one thing that's really nice about being a public entity operating a bank is that I think more so than a private bank, we're committed to long-term protection, and we're not really there for a profit. We're there to break even. And so I think we do things a little bit above and beyond what private bankers would do. On the educational side, we're developing a curriculum. We have year-round activities, and we're actually trying to raise $12 million for a brand new education facility campus. On the community side, the community has been involved and invested in this project since the get-go. The recreation facilities that we have are being very well used, and we have very large volunteer programs to help with our restoration efforts. On the partnership side, now for 12 years, we've been partnering with both government agencies and nonprofits. And new partners continue to want to, they approach us basically and say, we see what you do. We think we have a mutual goal with you. Can we join? And then on the research side, we've had a vast amount of research. Most of the research has been funded by the BLM through Challenge Cost Share projects. We also have, as I mentioned, the Wetland Development Grant for $200,000. And then we've had one PhD thesis, and we have a second one now that's also being conducted in the wetlands. And I think I have one more slide. The one slide I did not include, but I do want to mention it, is, and it goes along with some of the things that Josh mentioned, some of the things I think of why we were successful were, one, the people who were started the project, thought big ecologically from the start. They didn't think about what's the minimum we can get by with. They thought, what is the greatest thing ecologically we can do? And they shot for that. And I think they, and we continue to do that. We've, the West Eugene Wetlands Plan is now really becoming a part of a Eugene Springfield area open space plan, which is the West Eugene Wetlands is kind of a gem in that, an existing cornerstone, but we're building off of that to create river to ridgeline connections throughout the entire area. Number two, people believed it could happen. The people involved, the staff involved from the get-go believed we could do something great, and they did it. Number three, adopted policies do make a huge difference. I wouldn't be, none of us in our partnership would be able to get all the acquisition dollars and do all the things that we do without having adopted policies. Number four, community support from the beginning is critical. Number five, elected official support is critical. We give tours every year to our entire congressional delegation. It may not be the actual congressman or senator, but their staff comes out to our project, and we try to make them feel like it's their project, and then they come back in houses not too far away from here and allocate money to us. So it's a huge, huge thing to have their support. Number six, partnerships take nurturing. I spend as much time working with the BLM, their managers, and their staff as I do with my own staff. In fact, we jointly fund staff, so I have a city position that's partly funded by BLM. BLM has two positions that are partly funded by the city. And there was a Nature Conservancy position that was not funded a dime by the Nature Conservancy. It was funded by the city and BLM. So we jointly fund, co-locate staff, and that has really been beneficial, but it also takes a lot of nurturing. And finally, we adapt to changing circumstances. There are two concrete ways that we do that. One is funding. Funding sources and priorities nationally change all the time. And so as a recent example, BLM has lost funding recently for staff. And so we've lost a couple BLM staff. But at the same time, new funding sources for kind of private-public partnerships has increased. And the Cooperative Conservation Initiative is one such program. $5 million nationally. City of Eugene got $1 million of it. So when something bad happens or a funding source goes away, we don't really say, oh, panic. We say, well, what other opportunities are out there? And we go for it, and we're usually the first in line to get it before there's a lot of competition. Secondly, staffing changes. For example, our U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contact, who is an amazing partner, her name is Carol Schuler. She's the one that worked with us to establish the proposal for the new wildlife refuge unit. Shortly after we submitted it to D.C. for their approval, she took a new position with the USGS Biological Division. And after saying, boy, that's a bummer for us that you're leaving, our next question was, how can we tap into you and your new position to help us further our goals? So I offer those suggestions in often challenging times when we feel like we don't have enough staff or we don't have enough budget or good people leave, to think about what opportunities that presents to you to bring in new talent or to tap into new opportunities. So thank you very much.
We have reservations at 6, so I'm going to put some of these by the back door, but before we wrap up, I'll also hand them out to her, just in case anyone wants to. Okay, any direct questions for Eric, Kara, or Josh? We start with Alan, Palmer, John, and who's missing?
I've got a question for Eric. How come when you did your inventory, you just looked at jurisdictional rent? And this is post-swine or pre-swine?
Only jurisdictional, because that is what the, at least from my understanding, the regulatory agency, that's all they can regulate is jurisdictional.
Okay, so I guess it's pre-swine.
Okay,
Palmer.
My question is for Josh. Josh, you mentioned that your plan sets quantitative restoration goals, and a major criteria that you noted was historic extent of wetlands. But what other criteria other than historic extent did you use to actually set those quantitative goals of restoring these aquatic resources here and why?
Yeah, there was a long list at the end. Captured most of it. There were about 250 species of plants and animals that were considered as key functions. Those were rolled up into habitats. There was an analysis of connectivity and so forth, but it was generally a picture of, it came back in two different ways, a picture of what was the historical matrix or array of major habitat types in the region. We discovered, and it showed this slide, that every watershed has a certain array of habitat types, streams and willows and seasonal wetlands and wet meadows and vernal pools and tidal marsh bottomlands. Within a certain radius, you get all that together. When we looked at that, we realized that if we restored those elements together in that array, all the species of concerns that we had, we did that pretty much. So we came at it from the habitat side and the species side, and ended up looking at this sort of landscape array. And then when it got down to, you know, what you put where was a matter of looking at sediment supply, water supply, maintaining salinity gradients, those kinds of things. The landscape begins to dictate where these things are to be.
I'm going to take two more questions and then we're going to start the discussion with Ron and Fred.
Okay, my question is to Kara. I was listening very intently, especially towards the end. How did the politicians in your county?
They
do love it.
They love it.
So they will actually put this in, like, in zoning regulations?
Well, they now gave us the right to zone.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. No, we don't have the ability to zone.
Okay.
I was drooling all over. Yeah. No, but they do. They love
okay.
it.
Okay. Super.
Great.
When was this
Great.
Finalized?
It was finalized in December. I mean, that's when the model was this December. Yeah. So it's still being worked on. I mean, and, you know, again, we really don't have any teeth. The biggest political problem I've run into is that I've just tried to increase, and we have subdivision regulations, and I've tried to increase the upland buffer from 10 feet to 30 feet, and I've smacked running into a wall where I've just sort of run for cover because I've got this guy who's equating me to Saddam Hussein by taking away freedoms. And taking away, and, you know, and the takings issue. Which, you know, and I just really need to talk to you about, because we're getting accused of, you know, we're going to use attorneys that are just for a 30-foot buffer. I mean, it's just a setback from the wetland, from the jurisdictional line. So,
what would you say? Get over it?
Just keep going. But anyways, but the politicians, this, right now, they're in huge support of it, and they want to make the right decisions, and this is sort of a good way for them, and they're all Republicans. I mean, this is a good way for them to say that they're doing the right thing, and stay along those lines.
Because so many of the counties that I deal with, the county commissions say, well, we want development because we want to increase economic base. And if you have 100% growth projection by 2020 or something, phew.
Well, we have that money. I mean, we have all the tourism.
Oh, okay.
So they're not looking for money.
You want Disney World?
But eventually, it'll live on. It's all, you know, that big subdivision I talked about before, it was a 10,000 acre subdivision that's going on. That's actually way up in the northern part of the county, the undeveloped areas.
Fred, and then we're going to go
through. I just had the same question for Eric. How did you convince the politicians by taking 3,000 acres off the tax rolls?
I was bargaining.
And also, did you have eminent domain, or are you, these were all willing sellers?
All willing sellers.
Yep, all the acquisition was on a gain and seller basis.
Was it based on appraised value?
On appraised value.
Example for the rest of the country. Unless you're massive in pieces.
So part of the law was
the composition of the city council at the time. In that, at the time, it was probably a little bit more progressive or environment-oriented. Our county commissioners have always been slanted towards, you know, more property rights-oriented. Even the last amendments, which happened in 2000, we got a 3-2 split, three in favor. And I think the reason why we've continued to get things passed is because we've got the federal law, state law, with bill removal. So people know that this resource is regulated no matter what. And they've taken the approach that we'd rather have our local decision makers making the choice as opposed to the state and federal agencies making that choice. And they've agreed enough with the approach and the criteria that we use, and they can see the logic of it, that they have approved it. Because their other choice is to not approve it and then to leave it to the hands of case-by-case application basis. And they've been persuaded enough that this approach, it might hurt up front because you know up front in this process, you know which landowners and which parcels are not going to be developed and which ones are. So that is a tough thing for local politicians to accept that responsibility, but they have.
Thank you very much.